v. Abreu, number 20-2786, Ms. Arkell and Mr. Coyne. And feel free to take your masks off. Whatever makes you comfortable.
Good morning. May it please the court, Louise Arkell, Assistant Federal Public Defender for Appellant Junior Abreu.
Is it Abreu or Abreu?
I think it can be either. He pronounces it
Abreu. The Philadelphia Philly was Abreu.
Abreu, two syllables. Okay.
Yes. May I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
That's fine.
I do want to say it's always a privilege to be here, but it's been a special pleasure to be back in person. And I hope it continues after a difficult period.
It's good to have you.
Nasir applies equally to this case. In Nasir, this en banc court held that the Sentencing Commission exceeded its authority when it used commentary to expand the unambiguous definition of controlled substance offenses in 4B1.2B. In doing so, it carefully considered the guidance of Kaiser, which scaled back the approach to and reach of deference to agency interpretation or explanation of regulations.
Can I just ask you maybe, and maybe it's a preliminary question, maybe it comes later, what is the standard of review in your
plenary
thought process?
It's plenary.
And because?
I'm sorry?
Because
number one, we did raise it. It was raised, and we can cite, below we cited the Stinson and said, even under Stinson, that inconsistencies can preclude deference to guidelines. But even if the court finds that we didn't preserve the issue specifically enough, the district court certainly passed upon it. It considered it. It was aware of the Hightower, the potential unviability of Hightower, but it considered itself bound by Hightower.
Can you tell me where the specifically a Hightower discussion? Because I thought the rationale of your objection below was they were interpreting text that doesn't exist anymore and it was orphaned, and that's a different emphasis from a Kaiser claim.
It was a different emphasis, and Kaiser was not specifically mentioned. But and I also am not sure that defense counsel specifically mentioned Hightower. However, it was discussed at length by the court, and below we did discuss. I'm trying to find the at 110 in the appendix at 110. We talked about Stinson deference under Stinson and how it may not be applicable, and how if it's inconsistent, it shouldn't be applicable. It shouldn't be deferred to.
If you were writing this opinion, how precisely does an argument have to be made in order to be preserved for appeal? What would be your suggestion as a theme to us?
I think it should be enough to alert the court to the issue. The court was certainly alerted to the issue of the viability of, or the then binding nature of Hightower by the government, if nobody else. But the district court certainly, I refer to Williams, the Supreme Court in Williams, that exercised cert jurisdiction when the court sua sponte raised something, and in this court, Gardner, where it was the government who did not object to the application of judicial estoppel, and the court said, the court itself raised it sua sponte, ruled on it, resolved it, and this court said that was enough.
So you're in effect, it's two paths. One, it's raised sufficiently enough so that people are on notice that the issue is before it, even if certain cases aren't raised, or the court sua sponte deals with the issue. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Nasir, so before we leave this subject, isn't it a different argument to accept the premise that the commentary is controlling unless inconsistent versus the sort of separation of powers and, it's almost the inverse of that that was adopted with Kaiser and Nasir, that we don't give that deference if the language is clear, if it's unambiguous.
I'm sorry, are you still asking about the waiver issue?
Well, I'm asking about plain error, and if it's really the same argument, is arguing that Hightower applies, but the language here is inconsistent. Is that really raising the argument that was raised in Nassar? The Kaiser argument.
I think they're connected. I mean, the fact that Hightower still existed, was viable, was binding, I think sort of governed the conversation, governed the discussion. Now, and especially when Nassar, am I pronouncing it wrong? Nassar, sorry. When Nassar overruled Hightower, it gave its reasonings for that. I mean, that is now the binding law. So if it were in the district court today, that would be the discussion. The court considered itself bound by Hightower and proceeded accordingly.
Where's the Hightower discussion, if you remember?
I can point to it in, I know I pointed to it in my brief. Can I get the page sites on rebuttal? Thank you.
That's fine on that.
But there's no question that the logic and the conclusion of Nassar applies. In Nassar, of course, the court noted very simply, the analysis was incredibly straightforward. The guideline does not even mention inchoate offenses. That alone, the court said, indicates it doesn't include them. Same thing here. The guideline alone does not mention conspiracy. That alone should be enough to indicate that it wasn't meant to be included. The government's argument that this court in one line said it does include inchoate offenses, the court made clear it was referring to attempt, and that one line cannot change the black and white type of what the guideline says. It includes attempt, it does not include conspiracy. The court then made two points that bolstered the plain text reading. We contrasted it with the crime of violence provision, which includes attempted use, not conspiracy, and it referred to the specificity of the controlled substance definition, lists other offenses that qualify, and it cited the principle that I will not attempt to pronounce in Latin, the expression of one thing means the exclusion of another. And then this year cited a policy advantage, which is also equally applicable here. It protects the separation of powers. Not refusing to import an offense, an independent offense, into the definitional provision of a guideline, the guideline which has been approved by Congress, has been submitted and reviewed by Congress, that's the correct procedure for guidelines, not importing something, an independent offense, into from the commentary, which has not gone through that procedure. And yes, as Judge Bibas, you recognize the winds have changed. This represents sort of a turning point. The Supreme Court woke us woke us up from our slumber of reflexive deference. The same thing has to happen here. The government is essentially trying to reduce a definitional provision of one guideline into commentary of another, and then appending other commentary to that provision. The guidelines don't work by alchemy. They don't work by transformation. It does not change what is a definitional provision and commentary. It also does it by commentary. It attempts to perform that transformation by commentary. And the footnote in Havis refers to that. It's an even more tenuous connection. It's also, I would say, it's something of an attempted transformation. And I think there's a useful moment, there's a certain usefulness maybe in looking at what really happened here, at the reality. Instead of retyping or copying and pasting the entire set, the definitional provisions and the commentary of 4B1.2, the commission took a shortcut that made perfect sense at a time and has been perfectly useful for a time, but now the winds have changed.
So let's say if hypothetically we agreed with you that there was error, but we think we're reviewing for plain error. How can we say that the error here was plain when we're dealing with a different guideline section, when we're dealing with the term crime of violence, not that a controlled substance offense, and where there's a circuit split as to the interpretation of 4B1.2?
First of all, I think you look at appellate, you know, you look at error at the time of the appellate law, and that's Henderson. You look at the law at the time of the appeal. It is now plain error. It is now that it's the, where it's the same exact problem, just a different offense and the other provision. It's the same logic. To not find it error or to not find it plain error, you would have now two different definitions. That is one of the implications of the government's argument.
Well, no, would be saying error.
Oh, yes.
But not plain, given that this is the first time we're looking at 2K2.1.
I think because of the similarity of the analysis and the conclusion, I think there's no way to get around saying that it's plain error. I think it is plain at this point. I'm not sure that's answering your question.
Well, let's say it's plain at step two of Olano. We still have step four. Why does it seriously affect the fairness, integrity of the public reputation of proceedings where, you know, Abreu's co-conspirators took the overt act of shooting and killing the victim here? This is not, you know, it's not going to seem like an injustice to, you know, ordinary people observing this case.
For some of the same reasons the court pointed out in Nasir, it affects individual liberty interests and it affects the separation of powers doctrine.
Except that, you know, the Supreme Court took a different direction on plain error analysis than the one that we did in Nasir.
In Kaiser. This affects liberty interests. I think it's entirely different. Mr. Abreu's sentence was significantly higher as a result of the application of this enhancement. It matters. He would probably be out now if he were sentenced within the guideline range without that enhancement. There's no question. He's due out in February 23, if I'm remembering correctly. He would probably be out now. This is the reason. The government conceded that if the court found error, it would be plain because it would affect his guideline range. I think it was footnote 3 in the government's brief. It would affect his liberty interests. He would be subject to a different range, and I believe he would likely be subject to a different sentence. And practically, he would be out now as a practical matter. Now my time is up.
No, go ahead.
I think another implication that's important, I think, of the government's argument is that it would resurrect the controlled substance in terms of the controlled substance provision. Attempts would be would qualify as controlled substances. It would essentially, that same reading would resurrect what this court found inconsistent in Nasir. Am I making sense?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you spend a couple minutes talking about the overt act issue? And Quinteros was a different context. We're dealing with immigration there.
It's a different context, but it should make no difference. It has in other cases, but it should make no difference. Quinteros did a really careful job of undertaking the categorical approach for conspiracy. There is no drug trafficking exception to the categorical approach. Many of the courts that have found that it doesn't matter that the difference between overt act requirements or not in the drug for 846 offenses, they're very concerned that drug trafficking offenses are essentially the bread and butter or a staple of the federal criminal justice system. But that shouldn't matter. That is not for the courts to fix or amend. There's an easy fix. I think it's really important to note that these issues are not decriminalizing offenses. We're talking about sentencing, and there's a process for amending, for rewriting, for drafting, and for submitting to congressional review.
But don't we have something different here? I mean, we can talk about the commission's intent, and what we might gather from the face of the guidelines. But when we look at 846, we have Congress telling us that the penalties should be the same for the substantive offense as for conspiracy. And the reading you're urging would seem contrary to that.
The guidelines may sometimes not fulfill a statutory goal or purpose, but the commission should fix that properly. The court shouldn't be importing offenses into guideline text. There are ways to amend, and in the commission's eyes or the government's eyes, fix that. But it shouldn't be by making exceptions to the categorical approach. There is no question here that the New Jersey statute at issue does not require an overt offense, an overt act, and this court has ruled that it's going to apply a meaning of conspiracy that does include an overt act requirement.
Can I go back to something you just mentioned a moment ago? You said the government conceded in note 3 that Mr. Brewer-Brayu would be, if he wins, gets a lesser sentence, and conceivably he may even be out by now. That sounds like prejudice.
Yes.
But it doesn't necessarily sound like plain error. It just sounds like prejudice.
I think because it doesn't sound like, I'm sorry, like...
It sounds like he would be prejudiced.
Mm-hmm.
But does prejudice equal plain error?
I think it affects the justice process in that it affects liberty interests. I think this court has consistently held that a change in the guideline range, well, is prejudice.
That sounds
what you're
like
saying.
That
yes.
May go to the but fourth, prong
right.
of the analysis, but not necessarily the second prong, which is it plain?
I think because it does affect the fairness of the process in generally, just as deterrence, for example, is supposed to serve both specific and general, I think the individual liberty interest is supposed to involve or implicate both general liberty interests and the fairness of the process. You should be sentenced, defendants should be sentenced under the correct guideline range. And of course, it also, the prejudice piece, it certainly affects Mr. Abreu's individual interests.
All right, thank you. We'll get you back on rebuttal. Mr. Coyne. Welcome back.
Thank you, Honor, and thank you, Your Honors, and I very much appreciate being back here. I'm Mark Coyne for the United States. I was last here in October of 2019, and a lot has changed since then, but I'm very happy to be here in person, and thank you for that opportunity. I almost don't know where to begin, but I'll start with this. On preservation, we do think there's a difference between making the claim or raising the issue versus raising the exact argument. And we think, although it's only a non-presidential opinion, that United States v. Morrison, cited in our brief, does a pretty good job of explaining why that is. That, too, was a case where the Kaiser argument simply was not raised in the district court, was then being raised on appeal on that panel.
What precisely was the argument that Mr. Abreu made before the district court?
And I think, so the argument in the district court was that this commentary provision could only have been interpreting the former residual clause of 4B1.2a. And because that residual clause no longer existed, the commentary had nothing to hang its hat on. When we brought to opposing counsel's attention and to the court's attention, Hightower, and there's no coincidence here, Judge McNulty, who was presiding over this case, had in another case relied upon Hightower and issued a pretty substantial opinion explaining why he believed that Hightower continued to be good law, law of the circuit and law control.
Yeah, he was saying, until somebody tells me differently, I'm just going to follow Hightower.
Yes, but there was no argument made. The only argument in response to Hightower was the commentary is not controlling in all instances. And, of course, that's true under Stinson, but there was no argument presented here that under Kaiser, Stinson itself, the Stinson standard, must have been modified. That argument was never presented.
Wasn't the argument about the ramifications of the Johnson necessarily also entail an argument as to whether application note 1 to 2K1.2?
If you mean Johnson v. United States from...
with the guideline itself?
I'm sorry, if you mean Johnson v. United States from 2015?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, again, I apologize for not being clear enough. I think that was part and parcel of the argument that this particular provision, attempting or conspiring to commit a crime of violence offense, could withstand scrutiny only if it were interpreting the residual clause, the then extant residual clause, that is the one before August of 2016. But in response to Johnson v. United States, the commission amended 4B1.2 to eliminate the residual clause entirely and also to move certain, actually to add to the list of enumerated offenses in 4B1.282. But I also want to, I'm here not just to say the error wasn't preserved. I'm here to argue there wasn't even error in the first instance. Counsel, my good friend Ms. Arkell, wants this court to treat this as a pure 4B1.2A case. It is not. Nasir instructs us to look first to the text of the guideline provision in question. And if that text provides an unambiguous definition of the term in question, that pretty much is the end of the inquiry. The text here says crime of violence. There is no definition of crime of violence in the text of this guideline. There are three other guidelines that pose the same conundrum: 2K1.3, 2L1.2, 2S1.1. Each of them, like this one, uses the term crime of violence in the text of the guideline. And each of them, just like this one, then supplies a definition of that otherwise undefined term in the commentary. And what's more, those definitions change. 2K1.3 uses the same approach that 2K2.1 does. Crime of violence means an offense covered by 4B1.2A and application note 1 to 4B1.2. 2L1.2, the illegal reentry guideline, instead, in the commentary, provides a very, very detailed definition of crime of violence, a definition that actually, at least from my experience, doesn't map on precisely to the definitions contained in 4B1.2, even as a whole. And then 2S1.1, the money laundering guideline, it says it offers the narrowest definition of all. A crime of violence for purposes of that guideline, according to the commentary, is only an offense that satisfies 4B1.2A1. That is, an offense that has as an element the use, the attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against another. So three different approaches in the commentary, those approaches vary in terms of their scope, but all of them are purporting to interpret fairly and explain what an otherwise undefined term in the text of the guideline means. And so under just taking Nasir at its word, we are supposed to start with the text. Crime of violence, if we've learned anything in the last 30 to 40 years of crime of violence jurisprudence, is that that term is anything other than clear and unambiguous.
Well, if it's not clear, we have this issue about whether to turn to the rule of lenity. You've submitted a letter. The letter, your supplemental brief, suggests we shouldn't be applying lenity here. It relies on an 11th Circuit case that predates Pew, a 2020 case from the 5th Circuit, and both of them discuss the issues of fair warning and separation of powers, but none of them discuss, you know, the issue of avoiding overpunishment and tilting in favor of leniency. Why shouldn't that be our interpretive approach if there is, as you seem to be suggesting here, an ambiguity? Seems like that ambiguity ought to be resolved in favor of the defendant.
I think at least two answers to that, and if the court would indulge me. First and foremost is that my good friend didn't invoke the rule of lenity at all, either in the opening brief or the reply. And so from our perspective, Mr. Abreu has waived a rule of lenity argument. But second, the rule of lenity Stinson itself controls this case. Stinson, yes, is modified by Kaiser, right? Kaiser, in Nasir, this court held that we as litigants and you as Article III judges have to graft onto the Stinson standard what Kaiser says in terms of...
Kaiser tells us to exhaust the traditional toolkit of statutory interpretation, and lenity is as traditional a part of that toolkit as it comes.
Lenity is when you're talking about statutory provisions that define an offense or fix its punishment, which the guidelines, after Booker, do not do. These guidelines are mandatory. They're binding only in a purely procedural sense. The court has to accurately apply them to calculate the applicable guidelines range, has to accurately apply them when exercising departure authority. But after that...
Okay, so let's take this out. You want to analogize this case to Beckles. Beckles says as a matter of vagueness, we don't have to worry about vagueness in the guidelines because they're advisory. So that knocks out the fair notice piece. But then Pew, for purposes of the ex post facto clause, says, no, we do have to take seriously that even though the guidelines are not binding, we know they exert a strong gravitational pull over punishment. Why isn't that the better analogy, such that, you know, there's a risk of over-punishing, of jacking up punishments here. Therefore, we ought to lean towards leniency, regardless of the notice issue.
So, well, two things again. I think Stinson still controls this test in the sense that you don't
Stinson
get to...
Stinson is now modified by Kaiser.
Kaiser, yes.
And Kaiser sends us to the toolkit, and why isn't this the right part of the toolkit?
Well, I'll go on to the toolkit then, because the next step in the toolkit is to look at structure or context, and then after that... history and purpose.
Okay.
So let's look at structure and context. 2K2.1 has no definition. The commission says, look at 4B1.2A and application note 1 thereto. It's a flat, and there's no ambiguity there about what the application note says. But even if you think that this is a 4B1.2A case, which it is not, look at the structure of 4B1.2A. You have the elements clause in A1, and then you have an enumerated offenses provision in A2. The elements clause includes at least one kind of inchoate offense, forgive my pronunciation, but one kind of inchoate offense, attempts. It plainly does that.
This case could be distinguishable even if there's a general rule lenity, because 2K2.1 refers over to commentary and arguably incorporates it by reference.
Well, I don't think there's any argument about it incorporating it by reference. It flat out says go to 4B1.2A, all of 4B1.2A, and application note 1 to 4B1.2. So I don't think there's any debate about what the commentary here does.
Say we follow you there, but doesn't that just take us right back to Nassar? And the exclusion of conspiracy, a bridge that we've already crossed.
This court crossed that bridge in the context of a pure 4B1.2B case, not a 4B1.2A case. And if I could continue with exhausting the toolkit of statutory construction that I think applies here, 4B1, the crime of violence definition has the elements clause. Then it has an enumerated offenses provision. Four of those enumerated offenses do not require at all affirmative use of physical force against anybody. Those are the offenses of using or possessing a certain kind of firearm or using or possessing explosives. No force required at all, actual employment of force against anybody or anything for that matter. And so that, to me, is sort of collectively 4B1.2A itself is lending support to the notion that it does not unambiguously exclude all inchoate offenses other than the one expressly mentioned in the text of the guideline.
What do we do with the fact that this was in footnote 10 of Walker? The government has already taken the position that conspiracy is excluded.
In the context of 924C, but I have, and also for that matter, the Armed Career Criminal Act. But I do have an additional point to make about that, and that goes actually into the next part of the statute, next part of the toolkit, history and purpose. This court in 1990, now we no longer take this position in the statutory context, but in 1990, this court in an ACCA case, a statutory case, not a guideline case, in Presta, held that a conspiracy to commit a robbery satisfied the ACCA elements clause because the jury instructions for that offense would necessarily subsume all of the elements of the robbery offense. We don't say that that's the right approach now. But the question here, it seems to me, for this court is what did the commission intend? And was the definition of crime of violence that it adopted in 1989, does it support, you know, is it so unambiguously clear that you can't resort to explanatory commentary?
Could I go back? I think your argument about the text of 4B1.2A2 is clever. But first you have to get past 4B1.2A1, which says use, attempted use, or threatened use. So yeah. It's treating attempts as just like use, but it's not treating solicitation or conspiracy just like use. You don't think that conspiracy can be shoehorned into threatened use?
We're not arguing that conspiracy is...
Right. You're not arguing it's an A1 force crime. But it's not... A1 sets out a general principle, and then A2 has some very specifically enumerated offenses. And the fact that you can analogize your crime to use or unlawful possession of a firearm or explosive, A2 is not the provision you're supposed to be analogizing to. A1's the one that lays out the general principle.
No, but again, the statutory toolkit says you're supposed to look, among other things, at structure and context. And I'm pointing to an aspect of the definition of crime of violence right. That does pose problems for my friend. Again, if you view this as a pure 4B1.2A case,
right.
Which, as I've said, to the point probably of exhaustion, this is not a pure 4B1.2A case. This is a 2K2.1 case. And it's very clear, and what its very clear application note means and whether that deserves deference because the term crime of violence is simply undefined in the text of 2K2.1. But I also want to talk about history. And in this respect, counsel said something that unfortunately the Nasir court accepted as true, which is actually not true. We cite two amendments to the guidelines in particular for 4B1.2 in our brief, amendments 268 and 528. Both of them went through notice and comment. Both of them were submitted to Congress for review. Amendment 528 was submitted to Congress and in Amendment 528, the Commission expressly republished this commentary, the commentary at issue here meaning 4B1.2's commentary, to make crystal clear its view that conspiracies and attempts to commit crimes of violence or controlled substance offenses satisfy the definition in 4B1.2. Okay, so, and why that matters is because Congress allowed that amendment to go into effect while simultaneously rejecting through an enactment, and I can provide a citation after argument, two other proposed amendments that actually would have amended portions of commentary of other guidelines. And so the notion that Congress never reviews these, wrong. The notion that the Commission doesn't submit these and run through the gauntlet of notice and comment, wrong. This court in Berberina, a case that Nasir unfortunately never even addressed, an opinion authored by Judge Rendell with Judges Smith and Barry constituting the rest of the panel, acknowledged that the Commission, under its own rules, endeavors to submit amendments to the commentary and amendments to policy statements through notice and comment, and then congressional review. And in fact, it did for the two most important amendments at issue here, if this is only a 4B1.2 case. It did do that.
But Nasir was an embank case, right?
It was an embank case. And as Justice Frankfurter once said...
There's no way we're going to overrule it.
Well, one other point. Nasir is on cert, is pending before the Supreme Court on the Rehayef issue. Defense counsel, in opposition to the government's cert petition, has conceded that, in light of Greer, the judgment must be vacated and the matter remanded for further proceedings before this court. This court, assuming that does happen, and it was on the long conference earlier this week, so I imagine we'll see orders, if not Friday, then on Monday. Assuming that happens, this court will be in the same position vis-a-vis Nasir as this court was when McCants was vacated in light of Rehayef. And the question for this court will be how much of the opinion to reissue. I'm not, you know, that's it. You have,
when you look at Nasir, I mean, essentially what it's saying is the guideline itself is what you look to. and not so much the application with respect to the inclusion or expansion of something to include inchoate offenses, in that case attempting. Here it's conspiracy. Why don't we just simply follow the logic?
Because the guideline here, I don't think there's any, I'm not sure how one could say, especially after looking at the last 30 to 40 years of crime of violence jurisprudence and violent felony jurisprudence, that the term crime of violence has a crystal clear and plainly obvious meaning. I'll also add that, you know, baked into, you know, this application note also talks about aiding and abetting. And this court has long held that aiding and abetting doesn't even need to be expressly charged in an indictment in order for that to be a viable basis for liability for a substantive count. Pinkerton liability extends. Okay? You can be held liable for the substantive acts of your co-conspirator so long as those acts were reasonably foreseeable to you under Pinkerton. Now, look, we made these arguments in the Sear. I get that. And apparently we didn't make them well enough because they didn't persuade the court even to the point of acknowledging them. I understand that, too. But to me, the key distinction, again, if this is a pure 4B1.2 case, is according to this court's unanimous opinion in Nasir, that part of Nasir, the term, the definition of controlled substances offense in the text of 4B1.2b really was plain and unambiguous. It did not mention any kind of inchoate offense. Now, in reaching that conclusion, the court never grappled with expressly prohibit. There are now actually pending five different cert petitions challenging rulings from other circuits that essentially don't follow Nasir on this point. The Solicitor General, in one of those cases that's already been denied, TAB, filed a brief in opposition that made the obvious point that, and especially for those of us who had the privilege of doing even more work or dealing with Supreme Court practice than I've ever had, made the obvious point that under Braxton, the commission exists to iron out circuit splits. So really, you know, as a practical matter, this isn't a good case to spend, to consume the court's precious resources on. But it also spent about 15 pages explaining in some detail why it respectfully believed that the position this court unanimously reached in this year was wrong, why it didn't actually properly interpret the text of the statute, and why it didn't fairly characterize the history of these enactments. And again, and the part about Nasir on a personal level that is just as simply as a litigant that is puzzling to me is its categorical statement that amendment never goes through notice and comment or congressional review. That is false. It is just flat out false. It does. And to the extent that Nasir was relying upon separation of powers principles, of course, the guidelines are advisory. Mistretta held that even mandatory guidelines, that the Sentencing Commission itself and the mandatory guidelines framework didn't violate the separation of powers. Berberina said, the separation of powers concerns have even less force now that the guidelines are advisory after Beckles. But on top of that, even if it's only voluntary, that the commission just does this out of the kindness of its heart, so to speak, and I don't mean to be sarcastic, but their own rules say we're supposed to do this. And invariably they do. Not always. There are occasions when they don't. But again, Amendment 268 and 528, they did. Amendment 268 was so controversial that I won't say my good friend because neither she or I were practicing, I think, at that point, but the federal defender community offered testimony at the open hearing on 268 when it was still just in a noticed, an announced proposed amendment and said, don't adopt it because it will dramatically expand the scope of the career offender guideline. What did the commission do? Thank you very much. We're submitting it to Congress without a word change. It was submitted to Congress. And Amendment 262, I'm sorry that I'm beating a dead horse, that wasn't a minor amendment. It took text that had formerly been in the commentary and moved it into the guideline. It jettisoned what had been the existing definition of controlled substance offense, which pretty much tracked what was in 994H, and replaced it with a definition that is substantially what appears today. It also jettisoned the textual definition of crime of violence. That had been pretty much Section 16 of Title 18. It jettisoned that and replaced it with effectively the language drawn from the ACCA's violent felony clause, or actually definition, right? Put that in the text. It then took a piece of commentary, the provision about aiding and abetting, attempting or conspiring, that had formally, before 1989, applied only to controlled substance offenses, and applied it, moved it to Application Note 1, where it lives today still, and said it applies both to crimes of violence and controlled substance offenses. Those are really substantial changes. They weren't just to the commentary, they were also to the text, and they were all submitted to Congress in the very same document. So I don't think it's really fair to Congress to say that Congress didn't review it. Congress has an obligation to review amendments to the guidelines text themselves. And even if Congress doesn't have a statutory obligation, to review proposed amendments to commentary or policy.
But the question comes down to, why wasn't the text itself changed?
Pardon me?
Why wasn't the text itself changed to include inchoate offenses or inchoate crimes?
I think, so in Amendment 268, I don't think the commission thought that it needed to do that in order to satisfy the separation of powers concerns.
It sounds like what you're talking about is the equivalent of legislative history.
But Kaiser says that we are supposed to look at the history and purpose of the interpretive administrative action in question. And for that matter, the regulation that's being interpreted. I mean, Kaiser is all about what deference you give to an agency's interpretation of its own legislative rules. Well, the commission, and look, the analogy to, you know, what had been our and Seminole Rock deference, what's now Kaiser deference, has always been a little bit forced because the Sentencing Commission is a pretty unique kind of agency. It resides in Article III. It's an Article III agency. And this court had held in Berberina that even if amendments to policy statements didn't go through notice and comment, it still wouldn't violate the separation of powers because Congress could step in and overrule them. And so I mentioned this.
Kaiser tells us that when an administrative agency promulgates a clear rule, in this case, that inchoate crimes are included, any subsequent interpretations that expand the scope receive no deference.
I understand that, Your Honor. But again, putting aside 2K2.1, where it just uses the term crime of violence, which I submit does not have a clear meaning, right? And looking at this as only a 4B1.2A case, Preston in 1990 held that a conspiracy to commit a crime of violence, in that case robbery, satisfied the elements clause. We don't say that that is the correct way to approach the elements clause of the ACCA or 924C today. We don't say that. But this court held that in 1990, just 1 year after Amendment 268 went into effect. And so the commission could certainly rely on Preston as reinforcing its view that a conspiracy to commit a crime of violence really was a crime of violence, and not just as an interpretation of the residual clause, because Preston acknowledged there was a residual clause argument in that case, but refused to reach it. It grounded its holding on the elements clause of the ACCA.
Do my colleagues have any questions on the final issue, which deals with whether you need an overt act? I have nothing.
On that score, I would urge the court to adopt the approach of the five circuits now that have gone the government's way on the guidelines not requiring proof of an overt act when it uses the term conspiracy. I would ask that this court affirm the judgment below substantially for the reasons expressed in our brief and in our 28-J letter. And once again, I thank you on behalf of everybody in this courtroom for the honor of being here today.
Thank you. Ms. Arkell.
If I could first address or respond to Judge Bibas's question at the first go-around, the discussion of how the district court addressed Hightower is in pages 2 and 3 of my reply brief. And it refers, the appendix pages are 126 and 7 and 130. If I could just respond to a couple of points made by the government in its presentation. The government did not address genuinely ambiguous in its brief. It lays out, it cites some factors here, but it's making, I think, what is a very simple and straightforward issue far more complicated. One issue is that in terms of submitting to Congress, Congress has a particular job. The commission can submit commentary to Congress, but Congress, it is not Congress's obligation or function to review and approve or disapprove of commentary. The structure of the guidelines and the process is clear. Guidelines are reviewed and approved or not by Congress. Commentary is the agency's interpretation of that. Also, I think it's important that looking at, if even if you assume that because all the commission did was refer to 4B1.2 in the commentary, it doesn't make the commentary disappear. I think in determining whether it's genuinely ambiguous, you can look to the commentary and say it refers to 4B1.2. And what the government has not done is indicate, or is point to any indication whatsoever that Congress intended two different definitions, one for 2K2.1 and one for 4B1.2. The obvious thing that the commission was doing was simply copying and pasting, without copying and pasting, the structure and content of 4B1.2 and the commentary. There's no indication that it intended to meld them into making the definitional provision commentary and appending more commentary to that.
Before you sit down, I think you were going to respond to Judge Bibas's question about where in the appendix is the reference to Hightower's.
Oh, no, he did. She did.
I apologize. I was talking. My fault.
And I think, unless your honors have any other questions.
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both counsel for excellently presented arguments. I would ask if a transcript could be prepared of this oral argument, and if the government would be willing to pick